The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a New York state law last week that required people to show a special need to get a permit to carry a concealed firearm in public. In the 6-3 decision, the court's conservative justices said the right to bear arms for self-defense extends outside the home. The ruling left some states, including California and New Jersey, also working to replace similar laws with new public safety measures. We're talking about what this all means for our understanding of the Second Amendment and what states and local governments can and can't do. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that people should have the right to carry a firearm in public? If so, what would you like to see, if any, kind of permitting process issued by state governments, by local governments? Where do you draw the line on that kind of regulation? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Rubin is an assistant professor of law at the Dedman School of Law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. His work focuses on guns, the Second Amendment, and criminal law. His work was cited in the majority and dissenting opinions in this case. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Rod, thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, can you tell us a little more about what this New York law did and why the court's six conservative justices didn't like it?
Sure. So in New York State, in order to carry a handgun in public, you have to get a permit. And in order to get that permit, New York State, since 1913, has required that you show proper cause. And the way that that gets interpreted is by requiring an applicant to show a heightened need for self-defense, something that separates the applicant from the general public. In other words, saying that you just want a permit because you're worried that you might get attacked by a stranger and you want to have a gun for those random acts of violence in order to protect yourself is not enough in New York State. Rather, you need a particularized need that separates you from the general public, like that you've received threats of harm or that you carry a lot of money for your job or something along those lines. Back in the 1980s, most of the country either banned concealed carry altogether or had one of these New York style laws. But today, or at least before the Supreme Court ruling, New York was one of fewer than 10 states, albeit populous states, that had this sort of a policy. About 80 million Americans live in a place where in order to carry a concealed handgun, you need to show this heightened need for self-defense. And that's the policy, and the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional.
So let's look at the arguments from the majority. First of all, why did the majority say this didn't pass muster with their interpretation of the Second Amendment?
So the majority says that you have to implement the Second Amendment. You have to test whether or not gun restrictions pass the Second Amendment are consistent with the Second Amendment by looking at text and history. With respect to text, the Supreme Court said that there is a right to keep and bear arms, and to bear an arm means to carry it. And the court, the majority, says that it might be possible to restrict that right to carry a handgun, but in order to restrict it, you need to be able to point to historical analogs that are consistent with a modern day regulation. And by historical analogs, we're not talking about 100 years ago. After all, the New York State policy at issue is from the 1910s. They're looking at whether or not there's a historical analog that goes back to the founding period. 1791 is when the Second Amendment got enacted, or into the 1800s and maybe up through when the 14th Amendment was passed in 1868. And one of the things that the court, the majority did, was they went through all these historical laws and they said that none of them were close enough, none of them were good enough to uphold New York's law.
What did the minority argue in response, the three justices who voted to preserve New York's law?
Well, the dissenting justices, in this case, was 6-3, as you mentioned, and in the majority were the six conservative justices, and in the dissent were the three more liberal justices on the bench. They took issue with this test to begin with. This isn't the way that individual rights traditionally or conventionally get implemented. Ordinarily, there is a consideration of whether or not a modern day restriction sufficiently furthers a sufficiently important government interest. and preventing gun violence is no doubt a compelling government interest. So they took issue with this approach altogether. They said it's an odd way to do constitutional law. And beyond that, they did their own historical analysis, and they thought that the analogs, the historical tradition of restricting guns in public that dates all the way back to the medieval times, is sufficient to uphold this good cause permitting law that New York State has.
Talking to Eric Rubin from the Southern Methodist University School of Law, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court ruling from last week overturning a New York law on concealed carry permits and the way they work. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about all this. That's 800-642-1234. What restrictions, if any, should states have when it comes to publicly carrying firearms? Are there restrictions you think are consistent with the Second Amendment? Call 800-642-1234. So, Eric, obviously this New York law overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, you mentioned a handful of other states with similar laws. Does this go beyond that, though? Does this call into question other gun regulations that aren't so specifically like this concealed carry permit concern?
Well, the answer there is yes. Now, to be sure, one of the things that the Supreme Court did say in its opinion was that the court was not calling into question permitting laws that have objective criteria for carrying a concealed handgun in public. So many states have so-called shall-issue permitting laws where you still need to get a license in order to carry a concealed handgun. But the government doesn't have discretion to deny the license based on your showing of some heightened need to carry a lethal weapon. So in places with these shall issue permitting laws, you might have to go through a background check and do some training, both in the classroom and also live fire. But you wouldn't have to convince a licensing official that you are in danger and that's why you need to carry a handgun. The court says, both in the majority opinion and the concurrences, they make clear that this opinion does not call into doubt those policies, which is somewhat interesting because there isn't a founding era analog to such licensing laws. But in any event, one of the things that the court did here, as I mentioned before, was it said that you have to adjudicate Second Amendment questions by looking solely to text and history. And that's a big change from the way that the lower courts have been deciding Second Amendment issues in the past decade and a half or so. So this will, in fact, affect other challenged laws, whether it's a ban on so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines or restrictions on people who are 18 to 21 possessing a firearm. This changes the way that those sorts of cases get decided. And over the past decade and a half, most challenged gun laws have been upheld. In other words, courts have been rejecting Second Amendment challenges by changing the methodology and requiring gun laws to be shored up solely on the basis of history. That is a change that will call into question all of these other laws that have already been deemed constitutional, and courts are going to be asked to take a closer look or another look based on this new methodology. Now, I should make clear that history is always important. It's important to all judges. Judges frequently will look to history when trying to understand what the Constitution means, but most judges don't think that that's the exclusive thing that should be taken into consideration. Modern day problems and modern day gun violence have also come into play when the lower courts have been deciding on the constitutionality of gun restrictions. But the court has said that that modern day violence is no longer relevant to the analysis.
We're talking to Eric Rubin, professor of law at Southern Methodist University, expert on firearm law, breaking down the U.S. Supreme Court ruling last week that struck down a New York state law that required proof of a special need before getting a concealed carry permit, finding out what that means for other kinds of firearm laws in states around the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision if you've been looking at it? Do you have questions about it and what it means for wider Second Amendment related issues? What abilities do you think states or local governments should have to limit publicly carrying firearms to require permits? Call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Eric Rubin. He's a law professor at Southern Methodist University, expert on the Second Amendment, looking at last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling expanding the right effectively to carry a gun in public as they overturned a New York state law requiring proof of a special need to get a concealed carry permit for handguns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear what you think about this? To what extent you think state or local government should be able to issue permits, to set expectations for permits for concealed carry? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Dick is with us in Brooklyn, the Wisconsin Brooklyn, not the New York State one. Dick, hi. He's not ready. Sorry. We'll get to him in just a minute. So before we do go to callers, then I want to talk about, you mentioned a couple times, the last decade and a half of gun regulation. That's going back to the Heller ruling. Can you talk about what changed there?
Sure. So Heller, District of Columbia v. Heller was the 2008 decision where for the first time in the country's history, the Supreme Court declared that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to keep and bear arms that is not centrally focused on the militia, which is the topic of the first half of the Second Amendment, but rather is at its core about private self-defense. The significance of this was that before that opinion, the consensus in the federal courts was that there is no Second Amendment problem unless a person who is challenging the law as it relates to service in a well-regulated militia. The Second Amendment provides a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And that first half of the amendment, those 13 words about the militia, were seen as a limitation on the Second Amendment right. In 2008, the Supreme Court declared that those first 13 words are not a limitation on the right, that the right at its core is about private self-defense, and therefore a ban on handguns in the District of Columbia was unconstitutional. And that opinion, Heller, is still the lodestar Second Amendment opinion that has been guiding a wave of challenges to weapons laws across the country. That case, however, did not deal with the issue that was decided last week. It was about having a handgun in the home. Last week, the issue was whether or not you can carry that handgun into public spaces.
Let's go to our callers. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hi.
Yeah, so I have a question regarding how far the law really goes. And I look at all this discussion about the ability to have weapons with high-capacity magazines, rapid fire. So where does it end? What if I want to put a tank out in front of my front yard because I want more firepower to defend myself? This is a rhetorical question, obviously, but I like your opinion as to where does this end?
Dick, thanks for the call. Yeah, arms covers a lot of ground from, I guess, a knife to a nuclear weapon. There's a line. I think there's always going to be a line there somewhere, Eric.
Yeah, and this is – so this was a topic that wasn't at issue in this case, but it's a good question. It's one that's going to – it's been litigated in the past, and it will continue to be litigated. Obviously, at the time that the Second Amendment was enacted, firearms were, by and large, muskets. They were muzzle loaders. They took time to load. They were inaccurate. You couldn't carry them around loaded because they could misfire. Technology has advanced a great deal. So the courts have to decide, as a threshold matter, what counts as an arm. And most of the courts that have considered the issue have said that machine guns, for instance, simply are not covered by the Second Amendment. Fully automatic weapons simply are not covered. Now, semi-automatic weapons like AR-15 style guns that have been used in recent mass shootings, that's a closer call, though the consensus in the federal courts thus far is that it's constitutional to ban them. And it's also been the consensus that it's constitutional to ban large capacity magazines. In terms of a tank, my guess is that courts would universally, under whatever test you wanted to apply, say that you have no Second Amendment right to have a tank in your front yard because that is simply not what we count as an arm. Now, one question that's open after this opinion last week is whether this consensus about AR-15 style weapons is up for grabs. And I think in that respect, it's worth noting that the Supreme Court is holding four cases right now. We're gonna find out on Friday whether or not it will be hearing any of these cases next year. And three of them deal with either assault weapons or large capacity magazines. So maybe in answer to Dick's question, next year we'll find out just how far the court is going to go in this regard.
Dick, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dianora joins us now in Racine. Hello, Dianora.
Hi. My question is, I know that they talk a lot about these gun laws, but the real problem is all these criminals that have guns, they will always be able to get guns. How are they going to take care of that?
Dianora, thanks for the call. Eric, questions, I think, about the effectiveness of gun laws, people willing to break the law, willing to get guns. Does that kind of consideration factor into a court's decision?
Well, one justice in particular seemed very concerned about this. Justice Alito wrote a concurrence where he painted this picture of New York City that made it look sort of like Gotham from Batman, where people are constantly carrying around illegal guns and the bad guys have guns and the good guys need to have guns. New York, of course, contests that depiction. It's one of the safer large cities in the world right now. But the point is well taken. It's possible to illegally carry guns, and a lot of people do it. So what do we do about that problem? I think that it's a challenging problem. There's a black market for guns out there. And one of the reasons why there's a black market for guns is because there are roughly 400 million in the United States. And guns are finding their way into inner cities, into the hands of dangerous people with criminal convictions who otherwise shouldn't have them. Now, to be sure, it doesn't matter what law you're talking about, what crime you're talking about. There always are people who are willing to commit it. Even though we prohibit murder, people still commit murders. And so just the mere fact that people are going to violate the law is usually not a good enough reason not to have the law in the first place. And I think that one of the goals with respect to keeping the firearms out of the wrong hands is to make it as hard as possible for guns to find their way into the black market and to get into those wrong hands, such as by expanding background checks and the like.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Eric Rubin from the Southern Methodist University School of Law, looking at the latest Supreme Court ruling on gun laws, a concealed carry law in this case in New York State. Eric, four states that require a permit for concealed carry. You mentioned they can do background checks. That seems to be constitutional still. What kind of restrictions can they have? If we find X in a background check, it is we can say no to your concealed carry application, and it's still constitutional for us to do that.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you're going to see states do now, especially policymakers in these affected states, is look at the existing restrictions on licenses that go beyond this heightened need for self-defense and make sure that they're optimal for the changed circumstances. I think that in places like New York, this need to show a heightened self-defense, that requirement, was really the teeth of their restrictions. New York State, for instance, unlike many other states, did not require permit applicants to take any concealed carry class or to show any proficiency with a firearm in the range. There was no training requirement under New York State law. And that's because so few people could actually get through this other requirement. So tomorrow, New York State is actually calling back a special session of the legislature to consider changes to try to shore up their law. I expect that in addition to the background checks, you'll also see some sort of training requirement. I also wouldn't be surprised if policymakers look at so-called no-gun zones and sensitive places. The court has made clear that it's not calling into question whether or not you can ban guns entirely, whether or not you've got a permit from certain sensitive places like schools and government buildings, courthouses, polling places. And that list of places that the court has provided us with is not exhaustive. So I'd expect that there's going to be more attention on trying to carve out no gun zones, but we'll see what else happens when legislatures convene to try to optimize the law under these changed circumstances.
Did I see, when it comes to those no gun zones, did I see that in Justice Thomas's statement on this, that he said, yeah, you could still have gun zones, but don't push it. Don't use no gun zones to completely restrict people's ability to carry arms.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that this is just anticipating the next wave of cases. We'll see how far places like New York are going to go. At oral argument, there was talk about whether or not you could ban guns in Times Square on New Year's Eve or on the college campuses of NYU or other universities. in subways. So I think that one of the questions is how far can you go? Clearly, you can't declare all of New York City to be a gun-free zone. But what happens if you say you can't bring a gun within 1,000 feet of schools, for instance? That would carve out a lot of New York City. And would that go too far in the court's eyes? I think that the court probably doesn't want to become like a zoning commission for gun carry. But after this decision, they might find themselves in that position.
Briefly, as we wrap up, you mentioned some cases maybe hitting the Supreme Court. What is there one in particular you're watching for?
I'm watching three cases that deal with either large capacity magazines or so-called assault weapons. And these cases, which are out of New Jersey and California and a couple other places, the court's been holding on to them now for weeks and weeks, and they're going to issue their final orders, I'd expect, this Friday, just in 2 days from now. So I'll be looking to see whether or not they remand those cases for further consideration after this Bruin case on public carry, or maybe they'll take one of them. It'll be really interesting to see what they decide to do for next year. And if they decide to take one, I think that is a pretty big signal that this court is going to be taking a lot of Second Amendment cases in the coming years.
Eric, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Eric Rubin, assistant professor of law at Southern Methodist University in Texas and a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. He talked with us about last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling striking down a New York gun law and what it means for the rest of the country.